Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blue Jays From Away podcast, episode number 6.
Got this force coming through in my blood, in my veins, it's a current of love.
This week we have our minor league roundup, followed by the conversation with baseball prospectus writer Zach Mortimer, who will talk to us about Blue Jays prospects as well as the upcoming MLB draft. So sit back, ladies and gentlemen, take a listen and get your Blue Jays on. It's the Blue Jays From Away podcast. And now the minor league roundup. The Buffalo Bisons have gone 2-5 over the past week, going up against some very good competition in the Indianapolis Indians and the Durham Bulls. The Bisons have slipped to second place in the North Division and now sit 3 games behind the Pawtucket Red Sox. The team only had a couple of well-pitched games, but have been in most of the contests due to the strong hitting. Since our last podcast, Jim Negrich has seen his batting average drop to .377, and Moises Sierra has cooled off considerably, dropping down to .286, but he's now up to 5 home runs, improving his slugging quite a bit. Shortstop Ryan Goins continues to have a solid season, hitting .281, .333, .391. Goins is not known for his power and is putting up decent numbers in his first AAA season. The pitching staff for the Buffalo Bisons is very fluid, with Todd Redmond, Juan Perez, Neil Wagner, Ramon Ortiz, Mickey Story, Thad Weber, and Brad Lincoln all spending time with the big club in the past couple of weeks. Josh Johnson has looked good in rehab outings, and Dustin McGowan has given up 4 earned runs in his 4 innings, but the big club is apparently close to putting him back on the 25-man roster. The AA New Hampshire Fisher Cats have been playing some better ball and now sit 2 games under .500 and in 4th place in the Eastern League Eastern Division. This past week they went 3-4 but got a well-pitched game from Ryan Tapera and Sean Nolan. The team's pitching has been struggling as they now sit in 9th place out of 12 in runs given up and 10th place in runs scored. Kevin Pillar continues to destroy AA pitching, hitting .329, .381, .474, and has 13 stolen bases and 5 home runs. Shortstop Kevin Nolan has been hot lately and is hitting .276, .359, .440, with 5 home runs of his own. Ryan Schimpf leads the team with 11 home runs and has an .840 OPS, just 14 points behind Kevin Pillar's team-leading .854, despite batting over 100 points lower than Kevin Pillar. Starting pitcher Deck McGuire has had a couple of poor outings and now has an ERA of 5.17 to go with his 1.56 whip and 2-5 record. His strikeouts are still up from last year, but so are his walks. Joel Carreño earned a promotion to AAA with his strong season so far, throwing over 27 innings in AA, striking out 44 and walking 8 to go with his 0.73 whip and 1.65 ERA. Marcus Stroman has had 2 good starts and 1 really bad one, leaving him with an ERA of 8.10 and a whip of 2 right now. On the bright side, he has a 13-3 strikeout-to-walk ratio and is striking out over a batter an inning. Sean Nolan returned from the majors and had another solid start. In 20 1/3 innings in AA, he's sporting a nifty 1.77 ERA with a 1.28 whip and 20 strikeouts to 8 walks. Look for him to learn from his major league experience and develop even more in New Hampshire. The Dunedin Blue Jays are still in first place in the North Division of the Florida State League with a 28-21 record and lead the Milwaukee Brewers affiliate Brevard County Manatees by 2 games. The DJs have a commanding lead in runs allowed, leading the Florida State League by 13 runs over St. Lucie, but they sit in 8th place overall in runs scored and are definitely closer to the bottom of the pack than the top. Dunedin went 2-4 in the past week, losing the final game of a split series with St. Lucie, losing 2 out of 3 to the Tampa Yankees, and splitting the first 2 games of a 3-game set with Lakeland. Starting pitcher and number 1 prospect Aaron Sanchez is on the DL, so we don't have any updates about his progress. Third baseman Andy Burns continues to be among the league leaders in batting average, OBP, and slugging percentage with a .319, .389, .516 mark and leads the team in OPS of the regulars. Center fielder Nick Balagod has been red hot lately and is hitting .330 with a higher OBP than Burns at .392, but without nearly his pop with the bat. Catcher Derek Chung was also hitting .330 when he got injured. Chung's OBP is actually higher than his slugging percentage, with only two doubles as his only extra base hits out of his 29 hits on the season. First baseman Casey Hobson may only be hitting .216, but he's leading the team with 8 home runs and is slugging .440 with an ISO of .224. Since Sanchez's injury, the pitching has been led by veterans like Scott Copeland, Casey Lawrence, and Austin Beavens-Dirks, but there really aren't any prospects on this pitching staff aside from Sanchez. The Lansing Lugnuts have been playing much better ball of late and now sit in 5th place in the Eastern Division of the Midwest League with a 21-28 record. Until a recent 5-game losing streak, the Lugnuts had an 8-game winning streak from May 16th until May 23rd. The Lugnuts are 14th out of 16 teams in runs allowed, but 12th in earned runs allowed, which shows that the defense hasn't been good this season. The hitters are 12th in runs scored, which also shows that the team is probably about where it should be, near the bottom of the division. There have been 2 bright spots for the Lugnuts on the pitching side. Daniel Norris has emerged as a strong starter and the staff leader. Pitching only 4 innings per start due to pitch counts, he has given up 2 earned runs in his last 4 starts in total and has struck out 28 batters in the 16 innings he's pitched while walking 11. While the walks are still high, the strikeouts show just how filthy his stuff is. The bullpen has also been much improved with outstanding performances from Will Browning, who has only given up 4 earned runs all year and has struck out 43 in 26 and a third innings pitched. The Lugnuts also got strong performances from Eric Sicula and guys like Tucker Donahue, Ian Kadish, and Efren Nieves. Second baseman Christian Lopes continues to lead the hitters with a 314, 350, 426 line. He now has 4 home runs and has started to walk a little bit more. Third baseman Gustavo Pierre is one of the more impressive hitters on the club, hitting .302 with 5 home runs, tied for the team lead, and 13 doubles and 2 triples. This toolsy infielder also has 6 stolen bases, but has been caught 5 times and leads the team by a long shot in errors with 17. Dwight Smith Jr. has come on lately and has been showing good patience at the plate with 12 walks. As well as a little bit of pop with 2 doubles, a triple, and 2 home runs, and some speed with 6 stolen bases to go along with his .288 batting average. Center fielder Dalton Pompey has really fallen off lately and is now hitting .217. He is still walking more with 19 walks leading the team, but has struck out 52 times, which also leads the team. His 14 stolen bases with only 1 caught stealing is exceptional, but he does need to pull himself out of this funk. There is some good news coming out of Blue Jays camp in terms of Roberto Osuna's injury. He tweeted yesterday that he would pitch today, May 30th, at the Yankees complex in extended spring training. Hopefully he's on the comeback trail and won't need surgery at all. And that's our minor league roundup. Coming up in just a minute, we'll have the conversation with baseball prospectus writer Zach Mortimer. Welcome back to the Blue Jays From Away podcast. I'm here with Zach Mortimer, writer for Baseball Prospectus. How are you doing today, Zach?
Hey, you know, I'm doing pretty good. I'm here in the great state of New Jersey.
The great state of New Jersey, and checking out some, a lot of ball in that area and getting your reports from all the different, all your different sources there. Tell me about a few things that you've seen that pertains to Blue Jays prospects in the last little while.
Last weekend on May 12th, I guess that's 2 weekends ago now, but I observed Sean Nolan make his, minor league start before he received the call to the big leagues. I know he's been recently demoted, but what I saw on that start was he had a solid average fastball, which worked at 87 to 91. He spotted it well down in the zone. It's a pitch that he's going to have to command, and, if he doesn't command it well, he'll eventually get in trouble with it. It's not going to have huge bat missing stuff. I profiled it as a future average pitch. A new pitch that I saw him have was a cutter. The cutter was 84 to 87, and it featured some good late life. This will primarily be used as a weak contact. Not really going to miss too many bats with it, but just enough cut to miss the barrel of the ball, or have the barrel miss the ball squarely. He also threw a changeup, which was 79 to 81, had a little bit of sink, a little bit of fade, another usable major league pitch. The curveball he used sparingly, but in spring I saw him use the curveball and I liked it. It was one of his better pitches. It's a slow breaker. It's got sort of a big breaker with some depth. And that's another, you know, usable major league pitch. Essentially what we get to is he has four usable major league pitches. He's not going to be a front end guy, but a guy who can spot and use four pitches is usable in a major league rotation at some point.
And especially, you know, as the listeners may or may not know, he's about 6'5" and he's a lefty. So that always will play in his favor, won't it?
Absolutely. You know, he's a left-hander. He works from the third base side. I like his mechanics. Very easygoing. He gets to where he wants to go. It looks like he's going to have, you know, very good command. I said solid average or above command of, you know, the pitches, of repeatable delivery. He's got everything you want other than the premier bat missing stuff.
And you said that he didn't throw his curveball much. Do you think that may have been because he was working on the cutter or working on one of the other pitches rather than the fact that he didn't have confidence in the curveball?
Absolutely. I believe he was just working on the other pitches. I think the curveball is probably one of his pitches that's about as close to ready as any of his pitches. Therefore, you know, the Blue Jays probably told him, hey, we understand you can throw the curveball well. Let's try to make sure everything else is in order before we step forward here and give you the promotion.
Now, he was promoted, and he did have a rough time pitching against, I believe it was the Baltimore Orioles, because I think he pitched against Kevin Gausman in his major league debut.
He pitched the day after, didn't he?
The day after, yeah. So they were right in proximity there. What do you think a young pitcher like that, you know, I think he's 23, what do you think a young pitcher like that takes when they get promoted for a start in the major leagues and they struggle somewhat? They have a hard time getting major league hitters out.
You hate to say that it's a good thing to have someone struggle at the major league level, but sometimes it's a necessary thing. Now he can go back to, I believe he's back with New Hampshire in Double A, and he can work on the things that didn't work in his start. You know, Nolan can go out there on the mound and say, hey, you know, if I didn't spot my fastball right here, those big league hitters, they're going to hit it and hit it a long way. I don't care what this Double A guy is going to do. You know, it sort of pushes a guy to be the best that he can be, because now he understands what the competition level is at the major league level.
Great. And so when you're watching these games, you're watching from where? What part of the ballpark are you in?
I sit right behind home plate usually, 7 to 10 rows up.
And do you sort of find tickets like that, or are you able to sort of just shuffle down to seats that you find?
I have a media credential, so that allows me to see as much as I would like to see.
Well, that's fantastic, and it really to be able to see how a pitch is moving and where it's going.
Yeah, I usually try to position myself near the scouts. You know, that is my ultimate goal, to become a scout, so I try to do anything I can to gain knowledge in the field that I want to pursue. I feel that that's half the battle. For me, I learned the most about scouting after batting practice and before the game, because you can just go behind home plate and find a seat, and usually they're very nice, and they ask, you know, what's my name and who am I with? And I tell them, and, you know, there are a lot of them are very forward, and they offer a lot of information, a lot of good, positive feedback. I can actually say that I have three or four guys that I consider very good friends in three or four different organizations that I talk to on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I've actually used that sort of strategy of getting down to sit near the scouts a couple times when I was in Lansing, and I've also done that in Buffalo as well. And I find not only are they great sources of information, but it helps you, because sometimes the radar gun in the stadium, sometimes they don't have one at all, and sometimes the radar gun in the stadium is just completely off. So you can actually get a better read on how a pitcher is doing with their velocities by sitting near or right behind or right next to a scout.
Yes, that's always a very crucial thing, to have a radar gun that you feel is accurate within your vantage point at the stadium. The teams always have pitchers charting behind home plate, taking the readings of the pitches and everything. But yeah, the scouts are always a good, and most of them are more than willing to share, offer any information that you ever need. I actually have a little side story about it. Marcus Stroman. I met one of my friends, a scout that's with an American League East organization, by saying, "Hey man, I'm really sorry. I was peeking off your gun all day." And next thing you know, I met the guy, and now we're very good friends. We talk on a daily basis. One of the better guys I've ever met in the game. And, you know, I really appreciate all the information he's helped share with me.
Well, that's great. And I find a lot of scouts are former players, and they're very down to earth, very friendly, and very informative as well.
Yes. There's the select few scouts that you meet that are not as forthcoming and not, you know, really open to sharing information. But, this is all on the professional side. I did a couple amateur games. It's just basically the nature of the job. They cannot be as forthcoming and, you know, sharing with information because, hey, that's their neck that's on the line. They don't really want to give you everything they saw about this guy because who's to say I'm not going to run over and tell a completely different organization, well, that guy said this and what do you think? And, then it just gets a hole. So on the professional scouts, scouts are always very nice to deal with. But the amateur side, if you're ever in an amateur game and, you know, a scout's not as nice to you, believe me, he's probably not a bad guy. It's just for his job.
Right. So you were in New Hampshire and you saw this game against, I believe it was the Yankees farm club, the Trenton Thunder. Who else were you keeping an eye on in the Blue Jays organization there?
I was actually also looking at Kevin Pillar. I saw the New Hampshire team play at Trenton. So Kevin Pillar was one that showed a very good ability to play baseball. He brought everything that he had to the plate on every pitch, let alone at bat. He may not be blessed with the natural tools that, say, a guy who is a future first division player has. But Kevin Pillar was signed for only $1,000. And to say that we're here discussing a player who was signed for $1,000 as a legitimate prospect is, you know, nothing but a credit to the scout that found him. He's got a gamer profile. You know, he's a grinder type. He's a plus runner. He can barrel mistake pitches. I would say he's probably, you know, his hit tool might be solid average. The power's fringy at best, but you know what? He's going to make the best of everything that he can do every time he's at the plate. Defensively, he shows the ability to play all three outfield positions. To me, that says he's a future fourth outfielder, which, you know, may be a knock and people are like, oh, well, you must not like him. To understand the success rate of people that actually profile as big league players, you know, that's not a rate that's very high. That we're talking about a guy who is signed for such value as someone, you know, who profiles as a big leaguer, that's impressive. I mean, that's awesome.
Right, and I know it's a great credit to the scouts and the scouting staff that found him, but I think it's also a credit to him as a player to actually develop enough to be able to start to be considered a legitimate major league prospect.
Absolutely. And like I said, he's a grinder type. And when people think grinder types, they're thinking, oh, well, that means he's just not really that good and he plays hard. And that's absolutely not how I look at it. You know, when I say he's a grinder type, I mean, he's the type of guy I want to play with. He's the type of guy I want on my team saying, hey, go let Kevin Pillar get the at-bat. I know he's going to work his tail off to try to get on base or try to move the runner over or try to do something in order for the team to succeed. And you know what? The people always rip on the Arizona Diamondbacks because supposedly they're building a team with nothing but grinder types. But, hey, if they all play together and the chemistry's high and everybody works to achieve the same goal, I'll take that sometimes better than a guy that really doesn't care and has all the tools in the world.
Right. And so let's talk about one more guy on New Hampshire. You touched on some points there that I want to come back to a little bit later when we talk about the MLB draft that's coming up and the Blue Jays drafting strategy. But I do want to ask about one more player in New Hampshire that a lot of people have been talking about, mainly because he's a guy who hits for power and he takes a lot of walks, and that's Ryan Schimpf. He's a third baseman, but I think he's been playing a little bit at second as well.
Yeah, Ryan Schimpf. We had many talks about Ryan Schimpf, and you know what? The first thing I saw was the small frame. I won't beat around the bush. Ryan Schimpf is not a big man. I believe he's 5'9 and 190 something, maybe. And you know, at that point, you really have to get beyond that, because it's tough for a guy with that physical stature to profile as a corner infielder. What I saw from him ability-wise is that he had a solid average arm at third base, I thought. He really had trouble against quality stuff. They were facing one of the days they faced Jose Ramirez, which is one of the Yankees' higher arms in their system. We have him ranked number 3 at Baseball Prospectus. And, you know, Schimpf was really, he really struggled against him. And it was, you know, it's a shame because it might have showed some of the weaknesses that will always keep him to where he is. I profiled him as an Org Plus guy, which is a guy who I feel is not just an organizational player, but he's a player who's an organizational player with a positive benefit to the franchise. I think he'll be able to play for as long as he'd like to, because he's going to work hard. He's going to, you know, keep his teammates involved. If you need him to look after a guy that's younger than him and try to teach him the ways, he can be a guy that can do that. He also has enough ability to play at the upper levels of the minor leagues. He can hit mistakes. He got a 92-mile-an-hour fastball in the middle half, and he crushed it. So let's not say that he has no ability. It's just the fact that I don't think he has enough ability to profile as a big league, you know, a big leaguer.
Right. And, I, you know, I'll just relate some of my own observations about Schimpf, because I saw him mostly in major league camp, because he was in major league camp for a lot of the spring, and he did play, late innings to give guys a break, and he was actually playing mostly in left field, spelling Melky Cabrera when he would come out of a game, and he really didn't look like he could handle the pitching that was in the game at that time, which is generally you know, AAA, AAA+, or quad A players. So he looked to me like he was having trouble in spring training with that kind of pitching coming in late in games on a regular basis. I think he got about 20-25 at bats in spring training.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's like we said, it's a tough major league profile, but that doesn't mean he's a nothing to the system.
Right, and of course, having started to cover the minor leagues and start to talk to minor leaguers, these players are necessary all through the system. You need to have these guys, and they're very, very good ball players. And that it just goes to show how difficult it is to compete and to succeed at the major league level.
Absolutely. Every single team has, probably a majority of the team is an organizational player. I was told once by a scout when I first started this, 4 years ago, he said, yeah, you'll probably see, you know, two guys that have a legitimate everyday big league future on a roster. There probably isn't more than that. And that stuck with me. It's like, wow, there's 2 out of 25 or something like that. So that means 23 of those guys on average are just, you know, organizational players that are just going to, hey, you can make some money playing baseball. You know, if you get 40 man or something like that, or you can make a career making a little bit of money, you're not going to ever get super rich off of it, but you can play baseball for a living, and, you know, that's something not a lot of people can say.
Great. Are there any other prospects that you've heard about, you've seen, or people have been really getting the buzz going on in the Blue Jay system outside of New Hampshire?
Absolutely. I want to be the first to say that I liked Andy Burns in 2011, went down in 2012 and saw him, and was a little bit less, and then went down again with you. We saw him this past spring in 2013, and I said, oh, man, I don't know if it's ever going to work. And what happens? He comes out and is lighting it on fire at High A Dunedin.
Well, definitely. He's got some of the best offensive numbers in the league, and this is on a team that really is hurting for offense.
Yeah, Andy Burns, we had a guy down there that saw one of his games when he played Noah Syndergaard, former Blue Jays prospect. And Syndergaard threw, I believe it was a 97-mile-an-hour fastball that Burns was able to connect with enough to the fact that he drove it to the opposite field out of the park. You know, there aren't many guys, and from the report that I got, he didn't cheat on the fastball. This was something that he just went and got. So, hey, if Andy Burns can connect with 97 miles an hour plus consistently, there's a future there because there aren't many people in the world that can do that.
Right, and he also profiles as a very good defensive player. Early in the season, I was talking to the Dunedin Blue Jays play-by-play broadcaster Tyler Murray, and he was telling me how he loves Andy Burns' defense. He loves his arm. He loves his hands. Here's a guy who was drafted as a shortstop who's now playing mostly third base.
Right, and, you know, what people don't realize is playing shortstop at the big league level is one of the most difficult things that anyone could ever do. The fact that he was moved from short to third should probably not be a knock on the fact, you know, that he's a bad defender. He's 6'2", 190, so he's not the smallest of guys. So maybe he's a guy that shows the ability that he can play third, he can play second in a pinch maybe, he can play off or the corner outfield positions, making him a very versatile defender.
And that's obviously the more places you can play and the higher on the defensive spectrum that you can play is obviously great, especially for a guy who's looking like he can hit as well as Andy Burns can.
You know, exactly. And I like the steps forward that Andy Burns has made as a prospect this year. Another guy that I would love to talk about is a guy that, you know, maybe only dedicated Blue Jays fans would know about, but that's Will Browning. And Will Browning is a right-hander who is a sidearmer, and he's going to get a lot of people out. And I think he has a shot to get people out at the big league level.
Now, that's interesting because we were talking about Will Browning in spring training and we saw him throw in spring training and you were thinking that, you know, he might start to get hit when he gets to the higher levels of the minors.
Absolutely. And I still think that he's going to have to prove it at the high levels of the minors because, you know, the way Will Browning's living on is deception. The one thing that I may have discounted a little bit was the velocity. The fact that Will Browning can run it up there at 90 miles an hour from an extreme low slot is impressive. That's something that's going to work.
Okay, and I'll just clarify for our listeners that when you're talking about a low slot, you mean his arm slot, and Will Browning is pretty much a sidearmer. He's not a submariner, he doesn't drop down, but he's definitely sidearm. His arm is almost horizontal to the ground when he throws the ball.
Exactly. And that's deceptive. Another, you know, adjective that we like to use about pitchers. And sometimes people think it's a negative, and sometimes people can misconstrue stats because of a guy who's very deceptive. But, you know, a little deception is not a bad thing.
No, it's not. And, in fact, one of the things that I talked to people about, and I did talk to Will Browning when I was in Lansing. Another thing I spoke to some people about, I talked to some umpires and I asked them what they thought of some of the pitchers, and they actually brought up Will Browning and his slider, and they said that his slider is one of the best they've seen.
Yes, and you know, we had it at 77 and 80 with a sharp break, and it really plays well with the fastball, and if he can run that two-pitch combination, that's something that can really get him going.
Well, that's great to hear, and hopefully he can be moving up in the system fairly soon. The Blue Jays, especially in those lower levels, they seem to be very patient with their players. They don't seem to be in a big hurry to move anyone up. There's really only been one guy who was moved up from Lansing to Dunedin, and that was shortstop and multi-infield player Shane Opitz, who really is playing a utility role in Dunedin. He's not necessarily playing every day. He's getting some at bats, but, and again, not a jump out at you prospect like some other guys might be.
Yes. You know, it's tough because sometimes, organizational, like movement is not always not always reflective on who's the real prospect and who's not.
Right. A lot of it probably has to do with organizational need as well.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's needs at different places. Like we talked about, there's a ton of organizational players, and believe me, organizational players are going to get moved around a lot, and they're going to move around way before a prospect who is not considered completely ready for the next level.
Right, right. So, is there anyone else you want to talk about? I think, you might want to talk about Daniel Norris a little bit, who had another pretty decent start. I think it was his fourth one in a row yesterday.
I didn't know if you wanted me to touch the Norris bandwagon, but absolutely, I'll go after it. I believe preseason I sent over to you a list. I've always been on the Norris bandwagon. I've only saw him pitch in very brief stints, this past spring training. And, you know, he's impressive. I like him a lot. I think the stuff is there. And you know me, I'm very interested in what the guy's stuff is, because I think stuff wins games, misses bats, and gets you to the big leagues. Point blank. The mechanics, from what it was described to me as by a scout that I know that saw him, was, man, he really looks good. And then with a snap of the fingers, it's gone. And once the mechanics go, everything sort of plays down and things aren't as crisp as they need to be. And you know what? That's okay. He's a young pitcher. Let's let him develop the crispness at low A. Let's work these problems out when he's, 19, 20 years old. By the time he's 23 and he's ready to be a contributor at the upper levels of the minors or even the big leagues, then he's going to have that all figured out. And let's hope the stuff is where it is now, if not better.
Right. And let's look a little bit lower down in the Toronto Blue Jays organization. Who do you think is going to surprise a lot of people in short season ball in Vancouver or Bluefield or a lot of the guys who are going to be in Dunedin in the Gulf Coast League haven't been drafted yet. But I think a lot of the guys who are already in the organization and have had some buzz about them, and there's a couple guys you like in there, isn't there?
Absolutely. Let's hope that when I bring the name up Alberto Tirado to a Toronto Blue Jays-based website, that is not a name that people do not know about. You know, I think Tirado could be one of the best arms in the entire system. He throws from a standard three-quarter slot with obvious arm speed. You know, he falls off. He can spin off a little bit to the first base side, which causes him to lose the end of his delivery, but that's okay, because his fastball is 92-95 with excellent life down in the zone. He throws an 82-84 mile-an-hour slider with some tilt, and it's a plus potential pitch. The changeup is 84-86. It shows some fade right now. He can overthrow it, but guess what? It's another pitch that has had his plus potential. Therefore, he's got three easy potential plus pitches. That's not something many people can say. That I don't care whether you're 16 or you're 24, you know, a guy who has three potential plus pitches is somebody we need to worry about. He's young. He's only 18, I believe. The command's not where it needs to be yet. But let's let him develop it. Let's let him go to Vancouver. You know, figure everything out. Let's get him everything to everywhere it needs to be. He has a ceiling. You know, I said it's a number two ceiling. That's not something that's thrown around lightly, especially in my head.
No, I think a lot of people might think, oh, well, he's only a number two potential, but, you know, number two starting pitchers, you know, there are so few actual legitimate number one starting pitchers around. You know, there may be a dozen of them in the major leagues, maybe 15, that, you know, being called a number two starter, that's a pretty big compliment.
Absolutely. Like you said, there are only 12. There are only 12. I've gone through them with many scouts, and that's a different story for a different time. But there are 12 at most number one starters in the big leagues. Therefore, everyone else is not a number one starter. So when you throw around the word like number two starter, that means he's a real guy.
Right. And somebody that you're not just dreaming on.
He is someone I'm dreaming on though, because he is so far away from being, you know, in full season and things like that. So he's a guy you have to dream on a little bit, but he has the aspects that I look for in a guy that I want to dream on.
Right. And it's funny you mentioned Tirado, because he was one of the pitchers who was sent to Lansing for their crosstown showdown against Michigan State University, where the Blue Jays like to send in some of their pitchers who are going to be in short season ball into Lansing to give them a few innings and to sort of go easy on some of the college kids up there in the north. And Tirado pitched in that game, and he, according to the broadcasters, Jesse Goldberg Strassler and Slavko Bekovic, he was very impressive, as were some of the other young arms that the Blue Jays sent up there.
Yeah, he's gonna be one that's impressive. Did they send my, future man crush, Matt Smorl, up there?
I don't believe they did. They sent Chase DeJong and, Adonis Cardona.
I saw Cardona in very limited outings. The guy has a massive, massively fast arm, and that baby is impressive. Not sure he's a starter, might be a reliever, but man, the stuff could be serious out of the pen. Did not get to see DeJong, but all the things I've heard is that it's really going to be positive there also.
Right. And, is there anyone else that you've had a chance to see that you've got really good buzz on?
I actually have two other ones. The first one is, a guy that I just mentioned that I really, really like. That's Matt Smorl. He's 6'8". The ceiling is huge. The frame is huge. The gap is huge. He needs to figure out, what can Matt Smorl be? I was actually not able to see Smorl this spring because he had a cracked fingernail. And this cracked fingernail somehow kept him out every side session, every minor league B game that I was at, just always waiting for him to throw and, it'll be tomorrow. It never was tomorrow. He didn't throw, and that's okay, because it's not just the Blue Jays that did this to me. That there's a lot of teams that do that. They like to hide their precious first round draft picks and, make sure they're in, the best case to succeed, get the confidence up before the season starts, things like that. But, Smorl, the stuff could be huge. Like I just said, the fastball is huge. I think, he's a slider, and, the changeup, I think he showed the ability that he could pronate and create a usable pitch. All these things said, he's going to have to show the ability to repeat his delivery. 6'8". That's a very long body to repeat every time. It's something that people look at and they love the length and they love all that, but they understand that there's a massive risk because it's so hard for a guy his size to repeat his delivery.
Right. And I don't think you mentioned it, but Smorl is a lefty. So that's also another bonus for the Blue Jays organization.
Absolutely, left-handed pitcher. The reports I have on it is that the fastball has easy plus potential. The slider has easy plus. The slider could be more than plus, and the changeups got at least solid average potential.
Right, and you mentioned you had a couple more guys, and Smorl was the first one. Who?
Absolutely, the one guy that I saw, and I kind of it was very uneasy feeling when I saw him, because I said, man, there's a lot of things I don't like about this guy, but there's a lot of things I do like, and that's Tyler Gonzalez. He was a supplemental round pick in 2012. He's got an athletic build. He's at high three-quarters arm slot. He spins off his delivery a little bit early, but the fastball is 91-94 with good downward plane. I like that. The slider's 84-87 with some sharp late break and shows some tilt. I like that also. I liked it enough that I said that it could be a future plus pitch. The changeup was 82-83. It's a work in progress, but that's okay, because a lot of high school arms changeups are a work in progress. He got paid $750,000, so obviously they believed in him. He's a raw guy. He's going to need time to develop, but he's someone that I do believe that has a future, and I believe we should keep an eye on him, and, you might have something there.
Well, it's great to see, and with the short season starting up in about a little under a month, it's great to have some of these names, and our listeners can keep an eye on some of these guys. I mean, I will be in my minor league updates and on the blog, but it's definitely great to have these names in some of the some of the listeners' ears so that they can follow the players on their own once the short season starts.
I got you. And I got a sleeper name here for you. I believe it's Jairo Laburt. It's Laburt. He's a left-handed Dominican. He'll probably start in the GCLs would be my guess. I saw him, the fastball was 88-93. He's got the potential to even have more velocity than that. The slider was 85-86. He had a few cement mixers, which are sliders that don't break and just spin up there. And then he had a few that really, you know, broke. He currently has below average command, and this changeup was nowhere to be found. But hey, that's a young 19-year-old Dominican arm that has a chance, you know, another guy that has a chance, and that's all you can really ask for.
Right, so he's another guy, and I believe the first name is Jairo, it's J-A-I-R-O, and the last name is Laburt, L-A-B-O-U-R-T.
Yes, it is.
Right. Okay, so while we wind this down, let's talk a little bit, because the Toronto Blue Jays are going to be drafting in the 10th spot next week on June the 5th for the Rule 4 amateur draft. Why don't you talk about what some of the Toronto Blue Jays strategies in terms of the draft have been and what you sort of see them doing coming up this year?
Absolutely. I'll speak to the fact that, first off, I love everything the Toronto Blue Jays do when it comes to acquiring talent. They agree. My philosophy is about as similar to theirs as anything I could draw up. They look to acquire the guy with the highest ceiling every time. And for me, I think financially, value-wise, that's the only way to go. It's so much more valuable to acquire the guy who could be a superstar, because superstars aren't cheap. It's not saying it's easy to sign a Rule 5 guy at the big league level, but to sign a Rule 7 guy at the big league level means you're going to have to at least spend $22 million a year. So if you could get a guy and develop him and have him in your minor league system and get those 6 years out of him where he's not making the super, super high-end money, then you're really on to something. And I love the way that the Blue Jays have gone after these guys. Is it going to work every time? Absolutely not. Because there will be guys that just, you know, flame out, and everybody can see the ceiling, but the ceiling, you know, it's just not obtainable because they don't have the baseball ability to get there.
Right, and this sort of creates the dichotomy, and I think the Oakland A's were trying to do that, is they didn't go for the guys that had such a high ceiling, but they were looking for the guys who had already developed the skills that were being undervalued by other teams. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, Moneyball is the only way to go, because that was a situation where they had extreme limitations on their budgets. But when we look at the Toronto Blue Jays organization, we see a lot of really great-looking and really high-potential young arms that, when the Blue Jays traded, you know, two of their top three pitching prospects, it didn't leave the cupboard bare at all. But there aren't nearly as many position players who have that same ceiling or who appear to be able to capitalize or cash in that potential.
Absolutely. And you know what? It's very hard to sort of have it all. Think about it. The amount of prospects that the Blue Jays gave up this past offseason was, you know, it tops any offseason any team's ever had. They gave up the likes of Jake Marisnyk, Noah Syndergaard, Travis DeArno, Edini Echeverria. I'm leaving plenty out. I'm sure they gave up many more than that. Oh, Justin Nicolino, another great one. But the fact that we can still talk about their system, and it's still a top-tier system, that's amazing, and that just speaks to the great job they've done acquiring talent. They can get rid of all these pieces and you know, sort of go in for the big league season, which I know hasn't worked yet, but the talent's there. Let's let it, you know, it may not come together this year, and we might already be too far out of it. I hate to say that. You know, the Reyes injury and everything didn't help, but, you know, the thought was there. And if you're a Toronto Blue Jays fan, you have to love that. You know, your team went for it. That's all you can say. They went for it. They went in. They said, hey, we want to win now, and here's what we're going to do.
Well, that's absolutely one of the things that I think was one of the great things about this offseason for the Toronto Blue Jays. There was so much excitement built up, because the Blue Jays did go in with that attitude that's that said, you know what, there's an opportunity here. Let's go for it. Let's acquire all of this proven major league talent while they haven't been performing. Most of them haven't been performing at the same levels that they have in the past. Part of it is due to injury. Part of it is due to just not having a great start to the season. But the thought of let's just go for it and let's, you know, these guys are all of a sudden available. Let's go at them and go get them for our team. I think it definitely speaks to the strength of the minor league system to be able to develop the talent that could bring back so many quality major league players.
Yes. And you know what? Let's move on to the fact of where they get most of this talent from. You know, I know they do a fantastic job in Latin America. The Blue Jays, you know, have found a lot of really good players in Latin America, but the Rule 4 draft is coming up. And I think players that they're going to be looking at are, you know, two players I think they'll be very on are Austin Meadows, who is a, you know, he's a potential five-tool player. He shows them all. He was actually ranked, I believe, either one or two coming into the season. He had an excellent showcase circuit his junior year. I believe it was his junior summer going into his senior year. Looked outstanding. You know, things haven't been 100% where he wanted them to be this spring, but he's still a guy. Talk about high ceilings. He has a high ceiling. You know, he could really be a player at the next level.
Exactly. And I've definitely seen Austin Meadows, his name as being a guy who could be available in the number 10 range, especially since he's had a down start to the year, because I know the Blue Jays have really looked for those players who may have, you know, under the best of circumstances gone earlier and commanded a very high signing bonus, but they've gone after them even later because either they've had strong commitments to college or because I think Matt Smorrell's case, I think it was he had an injury in his senior year and he didn't pitch very much. So the Blue Jays were able to take him lower than he might have gone had he been able to pitch the full season.
Yes, they did have that. And, you know, if you want to talk about maybe Blue Jays fans are almost getting a little spoiled with pitching depth, but hey, there's another guy that they could pick, and that's Trey Ball, who's a left-hander with, he's got two potential plus pitches already with the fastball and the curveball, and he's also got a changeup that shows life. He was a two-way player all the way until, I believe it was late April when they figured out, you know, hey, he's going to be a pitcher the whole way. And, you know, he's a guy that, you know, if the Blue Jays got him, they'd be really happy because he's got a high ceiling also, and he could be a really good player. And that's something I trust the Blue Jays in the draft. Have they had some misses? Yes, but they're going to go after that guy every time.
Well, that's great. And, I think we've just about run out of time. We could talk all day, and we have when we were down in Florida watching some baseball. But I think now's a good time to wrap it up. And once again, I just want to thank Zach Mortimer, writer for Baseball Prospectus and Baseball Man Extraordinaire.
You know, I'm just a young kid living the dream.
Great. Thanks a lot, Zach. And hopefully we'll be able to talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Take care.
That wraps it up for episode number 6 of the Blue Jays From Away podcast. I'd like to thank Zach Mortimer of Baseball Prospectus for joining me. Thank you all for tuning in. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter @JaysFromAway. Come back next week and go Jays go!